Well, fans gathered for a cake cutting on Elvis Presley's 74th birthday and got word of two new residents at Graceland. Presley's ex-wife, Priscilla, led several hundred fans in singing happy birthday on Graceland's front lawn and announced that two rescue horses named Max and Bandit had taken up residence on the grounds of the famous white-columned house. Elvis, who died at Graceland in 1977 at the age of 42, maintained stables and riding pastures for horses at his longtime Memphis residence. With the addition of Max and Bandit, Graceland now has four horses residing in its eight-stall barn. Following the sing-along and the reading of proclamations, fans lined up for pieces of birthday cake handed out at Graceland's sprawling souvenir shopping center. It is amazing, though. 1977, he passed away. Man, it just seems like yesterday. And yet, still all the theories, all the mysteries abound. What happened to Elvis Presley? Is he dead? Is he alive? In a moment, our Gary Patterson joins us, along with Patrick Lacey, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, our friend R. Gary Patterson stays with us for the entire Coast to Coast program, co-anchoring this one with me tonight. R. Gary Patterson, a native Tennessean, a passion for rock and roll as a published author. Gary's works portray many fascinating events that helped shape musical history from Robert Johnson through current groups, making a place for themselves among rock and roll's standing legends. Gary is the author of several books, currently working on ideas for TV shows as well, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Gary, always a pleasure, my friend. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, George. It's always great to be with you.
And we're bringing on now Patrick Lacey, the author of Elvis Decoded, a detailed, in-depth examination of the facts and figures that permeate the many Elvis books, websites, articles, public boards, and he sorts through all the information and puts things in proper perspective. Elvis Decoded also covers scores of other questions and topics that have been largely ignored or mishandled over the past 31 years. Patrick Lacey on Coast to Coast. Patrick, how are you?
I'm great, George. How are you? Thanks for
good
having
to have you. Great. And Gary, say hello to Patrick.
Patrick, how are you?
Fantastic, Gary. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank
good.
You.
Good.
All right. Well, Gary, here we are, 1977. He dies at the age of 42. To me, right now, seems like yesterday. How about you?
Well, I remember exactly where I was. And, you know, it's just one of those events that's burned into my memory. Much like, you know, growing up, if we were, I don't know if you'd say fortunate enough, but in November of 1963, I remember being in elementary school, and I remember the Kennedy assassination. So, you know, here's an American president that's burned into my memory, and I remember the sense of loss. But I have the same thing with Elvis in 77, and I was older, but it was the music. I mean, I still hear it, but there's still that great sense of loss, and he still has millions of fans around the world, and I think Patrick's going to tell us some great stuff tonight. I can't wait.
Absolutely. You know, and I was 27, Gary, when Elvis died. I wasn't a huge Elvis Presley fan until years later when I began to appreciate his music and the things he did, and the incredible behind-the-scenes stories of just giving things away to people who needed things. I mean, that was just an incredible life of this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how it was with me. I think, you know, we're close to the same age, and I remember that maybe I was a little too young to fully appreciate Elvis, you know, in the late 50s. But my age group got caught up with the British invasion with the Beatles, but I had to rediscover Elvis. And I remember Elvis more as when he was doing the movies, you know, like Girls, Girls, Girls and whatever, and rediscovered, you know, the rawness and the greatness of Jailhouse Rock. But, you know, I'll tell you something about Elvis. He's one of the few people who ever opened his mouth and changed the world, because when he sang, everything changed.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I love to play the guitar, too, but when he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, he had that guitar across his shoulders. He made the guitar the definite instrument of rock and roll, so I know Billy Gibbons would enjoy that too. So,
oh, yeah.
I mean, he brought out the guitar and not the piano, so we appreciate that from Elvis.
Of course, they shot him waist high, didn't they not?
We had those moral codes on television, you know. Lucy and Ricky couldn't even sleep in the same bed. They had to have twin beds, and if they were, one foot had to be on the floor. So that was a very strange time period in American television.
Elvis Decoded by Patrick Lacey. Patrick, tell us, how did you get interested in the Elvis story?
I actually went to Graceland back in 1994, totally on a suggestion of a friend. I had planned on going to North Carolina for a vacation over the 4th of July, And totally as a fluke, we said, well, you know, let's go down to Memphis instead and see what's going on down there. My friend was a really big Elvis fan, and he thought that I would have a good time and it would be cool. And I had friends who were fans of Elvis's, and I think that Gary will appreciate this. I never really got Elvis, you know, that concept of either getting Elvis or not getting him. Uh-huh. And I didn't really get Elvis. I went down there expecting, you know, just to have a nice vacation. And something, when I was driving down Elvis Presley Boulevard, we got into town at about 2:30 in the morning, and we were driving down the street, and I saw the Lisa Marie playing on the right, and I saw the mansion on the left, and something clicked in me, and I've been doing Elvis stuff ever since.
Let's go back a little bit, if we can, Patrick. Many of us, of course, now know how he, you know, his start and, you know, his growth. But let's go back maybe 5-10 years before his death, putting him at around 32 or so. What's he doing right around that time period, 5-10 years before he died?
Well, he was doing movies, you know, of course, 65, 66, 67, and a little bit into 68 and 69. Then he got, you know, the famous 68 comeback special, which is regarded as certainly a milestone in his career and a milestone in the history of popular music. And then when he went into the 69 and 70 shows in Las Vegas, that's where he really, you really knew that Elvis was back now. And that continued, at least from my perspective, that kind of excitement and those kinds of performances continued, I would say, all the way through 72. And he certainly had a highlight at the Aloha special in 73. But things started to get a little bit, going a little bit downhill starting in 74 on through 77, I think.
If I recall, there was a point on his comeback where he looked pretty darn good. He had lost weight. He looked sharp. Went into the flamboyant clothes, but I mean, he looked sharp, Patrick, didn't he?
1968, the comeback special, and also the early Las Vegas shows. I don't think you could find a better looking, more dynamic performer than the stuff that he was doing right then. I think that is a standard now in popular music.
All right, then he starts going downhill. What happened?
Well, he had used prescription medication for many years. There's a lot of debate on how bad it was, you know, when it started and when things really got out of hand. But if you look at the things that were happening in the early 70s, a turning point, they say, was right around when he and Priscilla broke up. And the drug intake escalated from there, and he never was really able to get back his footing. And part of that problem is, you know, he had all those years of the movies that, you know, the quality you can look back on and question, but he didn't appear to, or he didn't seem to have liked those movies. He wasn't getting into, you know, the Colonel wasn't allowing him to get back into movies and do the things that he wanted to do. He was on, you know, back circuit tours that where he would hit big cities, but a lot of them were the smaller cities. And he got kind of into just a cycle of the same old thing year after year in those last 3 or 4 years. And I don't think that he was challenged by that. And I think he became complacent. And when you have somebody in that type of psychological situation, then you add the drug intake, you add some boredom, and things just don't work that way.
Gary, do you remember that clip? You and I were talking about it on one of your last appearances where Elvis just, like, forgot all the words in front of a live audience. Do you remember that?
I remember that. And then he started talking about, well, you know, I've got this guitar, but I only know 3 chords. And, you know, it was almost like he had realized he had become a parody of himself.
Yeah.
And I think that Patrick might agree with that, too.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And, you know, here he was like any Elvis impersonator, but he was Elvis. And, you know, he just seemed to forget it. And he seemed to be real with the audience when, you know, he was making these disparaging remarks about himself. And maybe those remarks came because he realized that, you know, he was stuck doing what he was doing and music had changed and, you know, he needed something to maybe revitalize himself. And maybe that's what it was. And of course, maybe it was too late at the time, but I do remember that, George.
Yeah, I think if you look, if I could just add something quick, like Gary's saying there, if Elvis, I think, had had a challenge like the 68 comeback special or the first show in Las Vegas in 69, which he was very, very nervous about. I think if he had had those challenges after Aloha, he may have, you know, risen to the occasion. And while the cycles may have continued, he still would have had peaks and valleys as opposed to just, you know, a series of valleys, which is what happened in those last years.
Patrick, what were his, how high was he? What was his height? What was his weight before he ballooned up?
I believe he was an even 6 feet tall. And his fighting weight back in 68, 69, 70, I would say was probably 170, 180.
And what did he balloon up to by the time he died?
That's certainly another point of debate among Elvis fans. Some people say he got up to 250, 255. Some people say he, you know, kind of plateaued around the 235 area. I would say, looking at him in those last years, a lot of that seemed to have been weight from bloating. So I would give him 235, 240, maybe 250 at his.
Well, we saw what happened to Jerry Lewis when they had him on drugs for his back problem.
Yeah,
I mean, he was huge.
Yeah.
And I wonder if something like that happened to Elvis.
Well, there was also a couple of times going through like 1976 and 1977 where you would see photographs of him in concert and he would look trim and healthy, and
yeah,
and then 2 weeks later you'd see photos from another concert where he would look bloated and out of sorts and his face would be a little bit pasty, and you know, some of that was from the makeup, but his appearance seemed to vary a lot in those years from between good and not so good.
Okay, tell us about the death that morning, what happened to him.
As the official story goes, he went into the bathroom to read around 9 o'clock that morning, told his fiance Ginger that he was going into the bathroom to read. There was a toilet, of course, in there and a chair. There's debate, a lot of debate on where he was sitting in the bathroom.
Where he was sitting, yeah.
Ginger got up around 2:20 or so, found the body, called downstairs for help. Joe Esposito, Al Strada, probably Charlie Hodge came upstairs. When Joe Esposito turned the body over a little bit to take a look at what was going on, it was obvious to him that rigor mortis had set in because the knees and some of the extremities had remained flexed, uh-huh, and his body was not moving as a normal body would move. From that point, they got a fire department ambulance, 2 paramedics up to the house. And the paramedics, I think they probably were pretty clear on what was going on there and that Elvis had been dead probably for several hours. Because of who he was, it would be the standard argument of, well, why did you take him to the hospital? Why did you, spend 30 minutes trying to revive him, which is what they did. And I think it's because of who he was, and they had to let the public know that we made an effort to save this man, even though
right.
He was dead.
He was literally stone dead.
Yeah, and I mean, if you talk to people who saw the body that day, it was quite obvious that he was no longer living when he got to the hospital.
Okay, now, there's been rumors that at the time, you know, now people call TMZ and things like that, the National Enquirer was there. Did anybody call them before they called the ambulance?
I do not believe that, and I don't believe there's any evidence for that. That claim has been floating around for a number of years, and it's based on some claims from a reporter for the Enquirer named Jim Kirk, and one of the head security guys for Elvis named Dick Grobe has put that story out. I don't see any evidence for it, and the National Enquirer was not there shortly after the death. And as I discuss in the book, there's just the way that Grobe tells the story, it seems more like it was pieced together as a piece of fiction, because the facts don't really hold up.
Was he healthy? I don't think so, right?
I do not believe he was healthy at all, no.
Do we know what was wrong with him?
He had hypertension. And some numbers that I've seen in my research have been extremely high and would make me wonder how on earth he could have been going out on the tours that he did and why he was allowed to go out on the tours that he did. He had some problems with his eyes. He had a colon problem. Part of the colon problem and some of these other things were made worse by the drug intake, Dilaudid being one of the key drugs mm-hmm. that he used back then, which pretty much shuts the colon down. And so by when we get past 74 into 75, but really 76 and 77, you can see the health problems, you know, visually when you look at photographs of him and see video footage. And it was just obvious by looking at him that he was ill. And, you know, you have to wonder, you know, I guess 2020 or hindsight being 2020, you look at those photos and you're like, you know, why wasn't somebody doing something with this man?
Yeah. Yeah. Or was he so bullheaded, Patrick, that you couldn't tell him what to do?
Well, a lot of the Memphis Mafia guys make that claim. And I used to hold a view opposite to that, where I thought, you know, so the guy was hard-headed and he was obstinate in this and that. You got to get the guy some help. However, in my research of Elvis, in terms of his psychology and the personality he had, I've changed my view of that, you know, 180 now, where I agree with the way that the guys from the Memphis Mafia viewed that situation, because Elvis Presley was in a very unique position, not only based on his career and his successes and things like this, but his psychology. It's hard to think about how does a person live like he did, being at the pinnacle of not only your chosen career field, but you're looked at as a god by some people.
Yeah.
You're held up to a standard that a lot of people just can't measure up to on a day-to-day basis. And even today, I believe that's still true. People still view him that way.
What was the cause of death?
The official cause of death was cardiac arrhythmia, that his heart had gone into
That's a very rapid beating,
yeah,
right?
A lethal change in the heartbeat. And that was, they say, based on some heart disease and that kind of thing. But one thing that's interesting about cardiac arrhythmia, though, is it's very much of a catch-all when you're not really sure what happened to the heart. It's just, well, we don't know what happened to the heart, so we're going to say cardiac arrhythmia because it covers any unspecific cardiac problem.
And they performed an autopsy on him?
They did, yes. Yeah.
Has that been sealed?
Well, that's another point of contention in Elvis' world and has been for a number of years. A lot of people say that autopsy report was sealed by Vernon Presley or at his request because he's the one who requested the autopsy. The fact of the matter, though, is that autopsy is a private medical record, and it has not been sealed by the court because it's not under the court's power to do so. They have no authority over that report. So that report is held by the Presley estate, and it will never be released because there's nobody who has the authority to make it be released.
Patrick, based on the way he looked, what was going on in his life at the time, mm-hmm. his frustrations, could you see him at that time faking his death in 1977?
No. When I started researching Elvis stuff, and I'll just say stuff because I looked at a lot of different things, I looked at these claims that he had faked his death. And I guess we think about the concept of faking your death almost as a normal point of discussion about Elvis. But the fact is that's a very, very bizarre, weird thing to do or to even think about. You know, imagine sitting down saying, hey, I think I'm going to fake my death. You know, what would your reasons possibly be?
Gary, do you share that? That you don't think he faked his death or he wasn't capable of doing it?
It would be very strange to sit down and say, in August of 1977, I'm just going to fake my death, give up my entire career, and just drop out. And, of course, I know, and we're going to talk about this later, I'm sure, with Patrick, but, you know, the idea that he was in a witness protection program because he had turned in some mobsters on drug charges and that he had to save his life by doing that, it seems real easy to create an answer later. You know, hindsight's 20/20. You could say, well, you know, he actually did this for a reason, and you go through this. But, you know, that's the thing to me. I mean, I just don't think he sat down. I think the thing was not well planned to do this, and it would be impossible to really hide underground because how much money would somebody get if they said, this is Elvis Presley, this is where he lives? Listen, money betrays everybody. This would be a billion-dollar project, wouldn't it, Patrick?
Yeah, the scope of a hoax like this would be so broad, and it would have tentacles going out everywhere in terms of EPE's business, in terms of the city of Memphis's business, medical professionals in Memphis, police department, investigators, Tennessee State Board of Health. It would be too massive to keep under wraps for 31 years.
When we come back, let's talk about some of the rumors, why people think Elvis may have faked his death on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Seamus writes, a couple of years after Elvis's quote-unquote death, I met up with him in L.A. He was going by a different name. He had lost a lot of weight. He was actually looking good for a man of his age. His reason for his death was that he could not live a normal life unless he literally disappeared from the industry. At the time, he was still singing. He was an Elvis impersonator, actually. He was still living his dream, but without the constant throng of fans and media invading his life. How about that? If he could be dead now, but believe me, he died of natural causes. That's interesting. Back in a moment with Patrick Lacey, our Gary Patterson on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our Gary Patterson with us tonight. This hour, Patrick Lacey, author of the book Elvis Decoded. Gary Patterson's website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, rgarypatterson.com, elvisdecoded.com, also with Patrick Lacey. Patrick, does it bother you when you hear so many stories and rumors about Elvis still being alive?
It does, in the sense that if somebody believes these things, that's fine. But I think they kind of have a responsibility to research them and try to some way substantiate the beliefs that they have. A lot of people, well, most people, if not all people, who believe that Elvis faked his death don't do any research on it. They take these standard claims that have been floating around for 20, 25 years now, and they just spew those over and over and over again, and they never do any work to try to see what's true, what's not true, where these claims came from. So in the sense, I mean, when somebody says, well, Elvis faked his death, my first reaction is, well, you know, that kind of disparages the man, and it makes him look kind of foolish. You know, gee, Elvis, you know, you faked your death. But I just, if somebody believes that Elvis faked his death, I think they ought to come up with the evidence, or they shouldn't say it.
Okay, Gary, join me here as we talk with Patrick and just kick around these various stories about Elvis, whether he's alive or not, the theories of. We've, of course, Patrick says, no way, you believe that as well. There is, Patrick, some kind of a photo. They call it the infamous pool house photo that many people believe is Elvis Presley, taken in January 1978. Tell me about that picture and what happened.
The photo was taken by a gentleman named Michael Joseph, and it's taken facing north towards the house, facing what was the pool house at the time. And inside the door, there is a chair there, and it appears that there's a figure sitting there. And because of the way the hair appears and the eyes and the facial structure appear, that a lot of people say that was Elvis accidentally captured in that photo. In looking at the photo more closely, there's a lot of photographic anomalies with that photograph. And if we stick with just the figure that people say is there, the hair, if you really closely look at that photograph, the hair really doesn't look like Elvis's at all. And, you know, Elvis in the 70s wore those dark sunglasses that have become, you know, so associated with him now. But if you really look at the photograph, the pool house photo, very closely, the shading around the eyes is not a pair of sunglasses. It's some type of other shading. And if you look at the shape of the shading, it's actually triangular. It is not the shape of sunglasses. So that the glasses right there are one reason that people think that that's Elvis. But if you remove that, you're just left with what appears to be a man sitting there whose hair doesn't look like Elvis's. So there's really not a lot of support for that being Elvis, although when you first look at it, it does appear to be somebody that resembles him.
Gary, wasn't there a cousin of Elvis who was at the funeral who said the body was not Elvis Presley's?
I don't know if it's someone in his family. I've heard that there were remarks made by people saying that it was a wax dummy, and I know that Patrick wants to go in. I had a good conversation with Carl Perkins, and Perkins was there, and he said that was Elvis in the coffin. And, I mean, Carl Perkins was one of the most warm, sincere people you would ever meet, and I think that sort of helped change my mind. But, you know, George, you and I both, we want to believe. I mean, this would be fascinating if something like this happened. And what we have to have something that's so concrete that it gives us a chance. And when I was listening to Patrick talk, I mean, he was saying that, you know, that a lot of this is accepted. Let me give you one. You remember the rumor that said that Elvis died at the same age of his mother? Remember that
yes,
one?
Yes.
I hear it everywhere. Well, Elvis's mother, I believe, Patrick, wasn't she 46 when she died? And wasn't Elvis 42?
You are correct.
And, you know, they weren't. But who did their research? I mean, that was very easy to find out to do that.
Well, Gary makes an interesting point there, is that when you look at a lot of these claims that are made, the research to prove or disprove the information that you're looking at is typically very easy. It doesn't take a lot of research to find out the information that you want to find on this. And the example that Gary uses there is perfect, and it shows that people just accept things that they want to accept, and a lot of this has to do with that they want to believe that Elvis faked his death, and so they take facts like that and they don't follow up on them, and then these facts just become facts, you know, year after year after year, where pretty soon nobody even questions them anymore. Another example is the claim that, you know, a guy named John Burroughs was seen at the Memphis airport buying a plane ticket to South America on the day that Elvis died. Well, does anybody do any research on that? No, they don't. They just say the claim over and over and over again. But you have to go back to that claim and say, who saw this man? You know, and if somebody saw Elvis Presley buying a plane ticket on August 16, 77, why didn't they call the police or call the newspaper or something? You know, and where did this? Who saw this man? And the person who saw that man, who did they tell? Where did this story come from? And nobody knows. And I contacted the Memphis airport, and they didn't even sell plane tickets to South America in 1977. So it's easily disproved.
Who is Bill Beeny?
Bill Beeny is a gentleman who claims to have DNA evidence that Elvis, the body that was autopsied, was not Elvis Presley.
All right. Now, with this evidence, I mean, where's he taking it?
Well, what he did is there's a lot of discrepancy on the facts of the time behind this story, too. He claims to have been in contact with a physician in Memphis who provided him with these tissue samples. And Beeny had these tissue samples tested, and he determined, or he says the test determined, that the 1975 tissue sample from Elvis did not match the autopsy body. Now, Beeny refuses to tell us how he got these samples, and he says, well, I got them from this physician. But if he doesn't name the physician, then we don't know where he got the samples. And he came forward with this claim.
Good point.
But just like every other claim about Elvis being alive, he makes the claim, he goes public with it, but then when he's asked for the evidence, he says, I'm not going to give it to you.
What can you tell us, Patrick, about the Presley Commission?
The Presley Commission was a group of people. I'm not sure how many people. There was supposed to be 22, 25 people. Only about four or five of them have come forward and admitted that they were part of that group. They put together this group in maybe the late 80s, or the Presley report that they put together came out in 94, I think. And they said that they were going to research and analyze and investigate the circumstances surrounding the death and then give an objective report on what they found, and, you know, did these claims about Elvis dying actually stand up when they were researched? Their conclusions were that Elvis faked his death, and literally every single fact that we have supports that. So they went into it with an idea that we're going to try to prove that Elvis faked his death, and we're going to twist and mold and bend all the information to that end.
Does the commission actively work on cases?
No, it was formed just for this purpose. Okay. It was not appointed by anybody. And a couple times they've disbanded, and then they've said they've gotten back together to follow up on certain points of their investigation. As far as I know, the thing is disbanded and no longer operates.
I remember years ago there was a Kansas City psychiatrist who claims that Elvis was a patient of his. Now, I had a problem with that because I thought there was supposed to be some kind of confidentiality here. Was that Donald Hinton?
Yes.
Okay, I remember that. What can you tell us about that?
Well, he claims to have been selected randomly to treat a man through, I guess, telephone calls, through the mail, however a doctor would diagnose somebody that they don't see in person. And he dispensed, I believe, scheduled 2 narcotics to this man. He eventually got in a lot of trouble for it. And he, through most of the story, he said that he never saw this man. Then as the story began to unravel, he said, oh, I've seen him. This is Elvis Presley. You know, I've met the man. That, of course, was not true. And since, I think it was 2002 that happened, I have not heard one word from him.
Nothing.
Nothing.
All right. To date, here, Gary Patterson, what do you think of these cases we've just talked about?
I think it's fascinating. Also, I was going to ask Patrick, I had heard that, was it in 74, I think, wasn't Elvis in the hospital with a life-threatening issue at that time? And I remember reading somewhere that the lab technicians actually sold samples of his blood and urine.
I have never, ever heard that, so I can't say if it's true or not.
But even then, when you talk about DNA, you have to have a very strong way in which you could prove the source and not somebody producing something and saying, this is Elvis's blood, and going with that. Isn't that true?
Yes, and I've also done a lot of research about the way the Baptist Memorial Hospital was run back then and run in the 90s, too, which is when Beanie says that these samples came out of the hospital. A doctor could not simply walk in and take any tissue samples he wanted, no matter what the date on them were or who they belonged to. You have certain checks and balances in terms of looking at samples there, so that if you are looking at a sample, there are people who know you are looking at it. So the only way that if this doctor went in and actually took these samples, and that's where there's a discrepancy on this, is did the physician have them already or did he go into the hospital and take them? I believe he went in and took them.
Right.
But there were checks and balances at Baptist Memorial, and I frankly don't believe that they have Elvis's tissue samples.
Who's this person, Patrick, running around claiming to be Elvis's sister, half-sister?
That is a woman whose name is Alice Tiffin. She changed her name to Eliza Alice Presley. And she claims that she is Vernon Presley's biological daughter, born in 1962, I believe, and that she has DNA evidence to prove this, and part of the DNA proof comes from the man who Dr. Hinton claims was Jesse. Or Elvis, who goes by the name Jesse.
Jesse, right.
Which is beyond absurd.
Is this a money grab?
you would have to call it what it looks like. In her public statements, she has said things to the effect of, you know, I'm not after money. I'm only after, you know, having myself declared Vernon Presley's biological daughter. However, if you look at the petition that she filed with the court, she asked for money. So right there, she's contradicting herself. Secondly, I think we all know that in Elvis' world, if you can make any tangential connection to Elvis, you're probably going to get a book deal somewhere. You're going to get interviews. You're going to get something out of it. You know, you can charge fees for showing up at Elvis events. So to be declared Vernon Presley's daughter and Elvis Presley's half-sister, even if she weren't after a payout from Vernon Presley's estate, of which there is no money left anyway, she knows good and well that there's money to be made. So the claim that, oh, she's not after money rings a little hollow.
Did Elvis have the means to fake his own death?
Well, it would require, I guess, a textbook written on faking your death, and then we could look at it and say, you know, did he have the means? I mean, he had money. He had influence. He certainly had power. He had loyalty, which I think would probably be right up there with the money situation.
Right.
I guess somebody in his position would have the means to fake his death. It's just a matter of, is faking one's death actually possible,
right,
based on the set of circumstances that we're working with here?
Did he have a motive to fake his own death?
I don't believe that he did. There are claims that, you know, his life was in danger because of he was going to testify in a FBI case, or that he was tired of being Elvis Presley and he needed a normal life and various things like this. I don't believe any of those stand up to a reason to be a reason to fake his death.
Not a lot has been said about the girlfriend that you mentioned he was with the night he died. Uh-huh. What was her name again? Ginger, you said?
Ginger Alden, yes.
Yeah, well, tell me about her. What do we know?
She was not very popular with Elvis's family or friends, and pretty much, I wouldn't say disappeared, but didn't really do anything Elvis-related after that. She has not made very many public statements about her time with Elvis. Every couple of years, there's a claim, you know, that floats around that says she's writing a book, and a book by her will be out soon. But I never hear any concrete information on that. So she hasn't really played a role in the post-1977 Elvis world.
Patrick and Geary, why the fascination with these superstars? Why keep them alive? How come the public tends to grasp onto them, like Jim Morrison and like so many other people?
But, you know, it goes back even further in history, George. I mean, if you go back to ancient Greece and Rome, they did statues of their emperors, politicians, athletes, and when they died, they were, you know, on Mount Olympus, or they were gods because they were so much above the ordinary person. Well, today, we don't make those people gods. What we do, we take rock stars. And look, James Dean, when James Dean died in that fiery car crash, the studios actually suggested that James Dean had survived and he was just horribly mutilated. So the James Dean story went in. You remember the story about JFK?
Oh yeah, that he was a vegetable somewhere.
Exactly, and there were wheelchair marks on a beach somewhere that was supposedly to prove that, and that Jim Morrison faked his death in Paris and made his way back to the United States. And the parallel is that someone claimed to see Morrison board a plane 2 days after his death. So it's always good to say, well, I saw this 2 days after he died, but there was not anything at the time, and it really knocks out the information in which you can find it. I think that one thing with rock stars and Elvis and John Lennon and everyone else, that when you listen to the music was captured at a certain time when they were at their best. And when you hear it, the music just keeps them alive. It keeps the image alive. And I think this is exactly what it is. I mean, they're too important to us as a part of our culture and a part of the music that we love to just let them simply go gently into that good night. And that's why a lot of legends happen. I mean, I've heard legends that John Lennon supposedly was alive, and we just can't let it go. And I know that there's a lot of people who really want to believe. I want to believe. But the problem is I've got to have something more than somebody seeing somebody enter an airport, you know?
Now, what do you think, Patrick?
I agree with everything that Gary said. I would just add that I think, unlike Lennon or Morrison or somebody like that, I think that Elvis, there's a psychological connection that Elvis fans have to him for any number of reasons. Some reasons I think fans can admit to themselves. Maybe fans can't admit to themselves, or maybe they don't even know why they have a connection to this man. Like I was telling you earlier, when I drove down Elvis Presley Boulevard that early morning when I arrived in Memphis back in 94, something clicked when I saw all those things, and I never looked back. So even I have some connection that I can't explain. Now, I don't believe that Elvis, faked his death or anything like that. But the people, I think, who lean that way or who are still who do believe that he died but are still very much involved in the Elvis world today, I think there's something about Elvis that connects to people, and people don't want to lose that. And I think I think also the further that we get away from 1977, some people might fear that connection will be weakened by the passage of time, and they don't want that to happen.
Gary, Eddie and the Cruisers, wasn't there rumors abound too that he faked his death?
Oh, yeah, and then at the end of the movie, he walks by into a department store, right in front of a department store window, and you can see it's him with gray hair.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of Eddie and the Cruisers, the whole thing is maybe the idea that someone sees Elvis with gray hair and they look at it. I mean, that it's amazing that film was based on that great urban myth and legend of the rock stars who faked their death and moved to the island of lost rock stars or whatever.
I remember shortly after his death, people were saying, this is how ridiculous it got, that they saw him working at a fast food place. And they were convinced he was there.
And why would Elvis Presley work at a fast food place? I mean, that's, you know, it's just amazing. But one point I want to make, and I heard this a little earlier, you mentioned the National Enquirer, and obviously Patrick's the guy to know, but didn't Elvis's cousin, Bobby Mann, wasn't he paid $18,000 to take the picture of Elvis in the coffin?
Yeah.
By the National Enquirer?
Yeah, the dollar amount varies, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he took that photograph, and...
Yeah. Okay. Well, Patrick Lacy with us this hour, author of Elvis Decoded. Our Gary Patterson stays with us for the entire show. Up next, Corey Cooper joins us. He's an Elvis historian.